Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening, Robin Williams with In Conversation. In a few minutes, I'll be talking to Richard Lewontin in Harvard, but the topic of our conversation will really be the scientist as superstar. Now, I'm sure most folk would regard that proposition as a thumping great oxymoron. Scientists aren't stars, let alone superstars. And if you were to ask a random selection of people in a bus queue to name just three top living scientists, they'd struggle to get one. But here's a superstar, now long gone, who packed in crowds in their thousands in Australia and in America, and whose books sold by the million still do. Stephen Jay Gould.
Any lineage now alive on the surface of the earth is here by good fortune of its survivorship through this lottery-like decimation of the vast range of diversity that evolved so early in the history of multicellular life. Now, there's a second point, a meta point, if you will, about the interpretation which I want to make, and I'll do it by means of an analogy, which will become clear in a moment. I assume the same problem exists in Australia as in America of backbiting and jealousy and parochialism among disciplines. They're the scientists, and they're the humanities people, and they're the chemists and the physicists, and everybody snipes at everybody else. And interdisciplinary communication is rare, but it's very precious and necessary. And the reason for bringing it up here is that I am a taxonomist. I work in the descriptive narrative sciences of natural history. Unfortunately, there is this status ordering from physics, the queen of the sciences, up on top, down through a bunch of squishy subjects, ending up with sociology and psychology on the bottom. Paleontologists are not much above that in that conventional ordering. I didn't say that to offend you sociologists. I said it to try and overturn that model as utter nonsense. But that exists because somehow the stereotypical image has been conveyed by certain scientists that there is one appropriate method in science called the scientific method, which has a set of canonical concepts associated with it: quantification, experimentation, rigor, repetition, prediction. All of these are part of the experimental sciences. There's an iconography also, namely men, and I do mean males, in white coats with spin dials and wait for numbers to appear. Look, when that kind of science works, it's marvelous, it's powerful. But that is not appropriate for all objects in this world that require scientific analysis. There are a whole other range of sciences that must deal with the narrative reconstruction of the inordinately complex events of history that can occur but once in their detailed glory. And for those kinds of sciences, be it cosmology or evolutionary biology or geology or paleontology, the experimental methods, simplification, quantification, prediction, and repetition of the experimental sciences don't always work. You have to go with the narrative descriptive methods of what? Of historians.
Stephen Jay Gould in full flight at the Australian Museum in Sydney. And now there's a collection of The Essential Gould edited by Stephen Rose, and it's called The Richness of Life. It shows just how wide was Gould's contribution to the public discussion of science. But it also poses the puzzle. How come a guy specialising in the classification of snails became so very well known? But will it last for scientists like Gould, Carl Sagan and others? Dick Lewontin was a friend of both and still does genetics at Harvard.
My general impression about people like Steve Gould and Carl Sagan and so on is that when they disappear as individuals and are no longer appearing on the stage and no longer writing, that their lifetime of acknowledgement by the general reading public is not very long, and pretty soon they disappear. Because their chief claim to public attention is their performance, both written and spoken. It is not like Einstein having discovered something which is supposed to be a fundamental truth of nature, or Darwin or Mendel. They are interpreters in a modern context of the current situation in science. And when they disappear, the knowledge of them disappears as well. There were many people in the 19th century who were equally famous, people who gave working men's lectures, supporters of Darwin. We as scholars know their names, but the general public never heard of them.
So there's not a new generation of people of that stature, or is there?
Well, there are lots of public intellectuals who keep making their appearance at a younger age than those people. Steve Pinker is one of them. Richard Dawkins is one of them. I mean, there's another generation, one generation younger than Steve and Carl. Whether there's yet a third generation following them, I really don't know, because the honest truth is I really don't follow them very closely.
No, indeed, but you knew many of them. Stephen Jay Gould made contributions to evolutionary theory, which seemed, at a distance, my distance, if you like, to be pretty profound, punctuated equilibria, and I think he studied snails as well. And then, of course, Carl Sagan did work on the greenhouse effect on Venus, which is the basis, really, for understanding of global warming and what happens on the Earth. Were they not substantial enough in contributions, do you think, to match the other ones you mentioned?
Oh, I don't think that's the point. No, neither Steve nor Carl were Einstein or Newton. They made substantial contributions within their fields, and those contributions stand and are referred to. But I think that's a very different matter than a general knowledge on the part of the general public. The general public doesn't know and probably doesn't care about punctuated equilibrium. Why indeed should they? Or on the greenhouse effect on some other planet. They barely have an ability to cope with the greenhouse effect on their own planet. So I think you have to distinguish between the broad visibility of a scientist when he or she is speaking to a general public and trying to address general issues, and the continued position that a scientist may have in the history of a particular subject.
One interesting comment you make about Stephen Jay Gould is the way he seemed to resist the temptation to make profound conclusions about the meaning of life and the state of mankind. Now, many people who are based in science find themselves on a public stage, and having talked about the scientific theory, it's only one short step to pronounce on these things. You know, what is the meaning of life and where are we going? What is it all about? Do you sympathize with that syndrome?
Do I sympathize with the syndrome of the latter, namely to talk about things way outside their field and beyond their knowledge? No, I don't sympathize with it at all. I think the temptation is very great. And the reason the temptation is so great is because scientists are educated from a very early age to believe that the greatest scientist is a scientist who makes discoveries or theories that apply to the greatest ambit of things in the world. And if you have only made a very good theory about snails or a very good theory about some planets, but not about the universe as a whole or about all the history of humankind, then you have in some sense accepted a lower position in the hierarchy of the fame of science as it's taught to you as a young student. So if you're a very ambitious person, then you try to claim that what you have worked with has an immensely broad ambit of application to all of human history, to all of humankind, to all of the future, to the whole universe. And why it is that Carl Sagan and Steve Gould resisted that temptation, I don't know. The fact of the matter is that the world is full of people who, having achieved a certain professional level in one field or another, break out from that and make claims and write books and appear on TV and radio and so on, talking about everything in the world, because that's how you get to be famous. When, if I ask you, who is the most famous scientist who ever lived, or the greatest scientist who ever lived, you'll say either Einstein or Newton or something like that, because their claims were supposed to apply universally. But the claim of somebody who is studying a particular feature of the evolutionary process, like whether it's very fast or very slow or occurs in steps and so on, that's not a universal claim. That's a rather specialized claim. And so you can't claim to great fame and great success.
Look at the syndromes, on the other hand, of a couple of examples. I don't want to get you into trouble with any of your colleagues, but not terribly far away is E.O. Wilson, Ed Wilson, in this very faculty at Harvard. And he wrote a book on ants, and one small part of it did a leap towards humanity, and the word sociobiology became famous and made him famous, in fact, you know, talking about we are biological things and therefore the rest follows. And he's still talking about the fate of mankind. I have asked him on occasion about why he does that. Do you think he's taken too big a step?
I think he is a classic case of somebody whose ambition was so great and remains so great, apparently, that just knowing all about ants is not enough to satisfy it. I mean, after all, they're just ants. If you really want to say something important, you say it about people. He's a classic case of someone who gave in to that seduction of fame based on explaining everything there is to know about the human species. He went on, by the way, in another direction when it's clear that that business about sociobiology and especially about humans was getting him into a great deal of difficulties. He more or less dropped it and went into the problem of species survival and species extinction, which nobody could quarrel with, after all. And if you became famous as a crusader for the maintenance of species, no one could accuse you of bad politics or something of that kind. Yes, I think Ed's a classic case.
One of the reasons he's pretty famous is not simply the size of his ideas, it's he can write. He writes good English. People can read it and enjoy his books. Is that not one thing that people... In fact, Stephen Jay Gould was a good writer as well.
Well, if you can't write well, then your ambition to become famous in this way will be frustrated. Either that or you have to get an amanuensis who will write for you. So yes, there's only a subgroup of people with that kind of ambition. I mean, another example is Jared Diamond, who is, after all, a physiologist and a geographical biologist who decided he wanted to write about the history of human species. And he happens to be a good writer. If he were a bad writer, he wouldn't get away with it.
No, certainly not. But he's also talking about the future of mankind. His last book, Collapse, was a series of case histories of societies which indeed did take the wrong turn in the sense that a risk too far, they cut down the last tree. And the implications for the future of human beings is profound. So it's one of the biggest questions of all he seems to be answering.
Well, he seems to be answering. He's making up stories about that. It's a little hard to know whether the stories are true or not. They did indeed cut down the last tree, but it might pay to have a little trip around Greece. The Greeks cut down the last tree a very long time ago. They essentially deforested it. The English, for that matter, as compared to the forests that existed in the 10th, 11th, and 12th century, have not cut down the last tree, but damn close to it. But it doesn't seem to have done them any harm. History has got a lot to do with unique circumstances under certain particular cases, and grand theories will always find counter cases. I don't think that people whose expertise lies in one thing should try to make grand theories about something, A, where it's very hard to get the evidence to prove that you're right, and B, where it's much too easy to make up stories that seem right. We do have this tendency now, in biology especially, to make up stories, to make theoretical biology a kind of game. In fact, we have game theory in biology, which is meant to use the theory of games to make predictions or explain things. But in fact, it's an elaborate game. It's claimed that J.B.S. Haldane once said that something was interesting even if not true. Now, whether Haldane actually said that or not is not the issue. The notion that one is a scholar and a scientist whose chief goal is to say something interesting even if not true is one with which I have no sympathy whatsoever. In my mind, the job of a natural scientist is to bend over backwards to say something which can be demonstrated to be true, or at least which is of not such a nature that there's no way to demonstrate that it's false.
Which brings me to the rather large head on the wall. It looks like a moose. And there's, I presume, a long-distant relative of the moose, the elk with gigantic antlers, which everyone assumed had evolved itself out of existence because its antlers were too large. And that turns out to be a myth, in fact, does it not? What's the evidence?
Well, there are different kinds of evidence. One is that the antlers of that elk were exactly the size an antler should be for an elk of that size. That is to say, if you make a plot of antler size against body size in deer, of which the elk is an example, then its antlers were just the size you would have predicted from the size of its body. They were not excessively large for the body. Second, as far as extinction is concerned, we don't know why that elk went extinct. What we do know is that every species goes extinct for some reason or other. All the elk's ancestors went extinct. It went extinct. And all the moose and elk and deer that are now alive will one day go extinct, even if people do nothing about it, because extinction is the rule. In fact, perhaps the only law in biology is that all flesh is mortal and all species become extinct eventually. Why you would suppose that you have to have a special story for this elk because of its antlers, I cannot imagine as a biologist, but I can imagine it as a storyteller.
Why is the moose on your wall?
The moose is on the wall because someone shot it. One day when I used to have a very large laboratory, some of us went up into the attic of this museum to look to see what was up there, and there we found a number of preserved dried specimens, including this plaque on which this huge moose head was. And we thought, well, it's just lost to human sight. Let's bring it downstairs and hang it on the wall so people can see it. So we did. It was a pure whim. It doesn't symbolize anything.
But the elk, to me, does in this argument, because you talked about getting the science right. Now, an awful lot of scientists these days are concerned about the biological future of the planet, obviously, and their understanding is based on evidence, on testable evidence and so forth. And yet there's this quandary about the amount of time we have, and therefore lots of the statements necessarily become urgent and they enter the realm of politics. The scientists are on a political stage, and famously so. Now, this is not foreign to you because you've been interested in politics all your life, all your career. How would you see them these days being confronted by critics, usually from the conservative part of politics, saying that they don't know what they're talking about, the science isn't in yet, be it on global warming or species extinction or whatever? Is it a kind of no-win situation for the scientists?
Well, I don't think it's a no-win situation for the scientist who says this, because there's a lot of public sympathy and agreement with this. The background of the problem is as follows. All during geologic history, it has got warmer and then colder, warmer and then colder. We've had melting periods and freezing periods. We had glaciers in North America only some tens of thousands of years ago. They melted. We expect that there will be fluctuation. The size of those fluctuations, which we judge from the fossil record and from the geological record, are variable in size at various times. Secondly, all species go extinct. Species have been going extinct for a long time, and species are going extinct now. Now, the problem is, how do we see the signal of a higher extinction rate and a greater warming rate than we might expect from human activity against this background of a long history of warming and cooling of species extinction? That's why it's so hard for scientists to convince many people that something unusual is happening, because they say, well, look, this has always been going on. How do you know it's greater now than would be if we weren't here? I'm not saying that it isn't greater. I'm saying it would be very hard to demonstrate that on the background of the variability. The issues here are a priori issues. There are people who come to the problem with alarm about the way the world is going, about alarm at the spread of all kinds of nasty industrial pollution and waste, which is doing people a lot of harm, people who have various kinds of politics for whom it is congenial for their a priori politics to say, yes, things are getting much worse. They're opposed by people who also have a priori politics, saying that this is the best of all possible worlds, capitalism is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and you're just alarmists, and so on, and they can massage the data so it fits them. So the problem is you have variable history with a small signal which can appeal on either side to a priori social and political claims, and that's why it's so difficult to find out what's really happening. The issue is made worse, in my opinion, because if I put myself on the side of those who see the world as warming up in a bad way, who see the general march of industrial culture as something undesirable, the one thing I must beware of doing, and which my colleagues on that side don't beware of doing, we must beware of saying, we've got to stop changing the environment. There is no the environment which we can change. The world is changing all the time. If we're going to make a politically responsible and a scientifically sensible claim, it should not be stop the world exactly where it is, because that's not possible. It has to be to decide what kind of world do we as human beings want to live in. There are competing interests. And so reaching any kind of consensus is not just a matter of voting. It's a matter of who will be in political power. And whoever's in political power, they will want to do something with the world that makes the people whom they represent and whom they feel akin to change in a way that's satisfactory for them. So in the end, it's a political problem.
It would be a political problem, and simply that, as it's always been, if we had the time. An awful lot of people, like Tim Flannery in Australia, who's talked about the Weathermakers, and Bob May, whom you'd know, who does calculations on species extinction and various other environmental changes. One could list the names of those who say that the change at the moment is so fast that just waiting for things to go through in the normal way is a luxury we can't afford. And maybe one has to be rather more stentorian and urgent about some of the statements being made than normally might be the case.
Well, the issue is not, again, to oppose changes. The issue is who has the power to oppose them, and for whose good will those changes or the stopping of those changes be? Whatever Bob May may say, the people in the two houses of Parliament and the Prime Minister's office are really the powerful people. And the question is, who do they represent? And if Bob doesn't represent them, then nothing Bob can say can change them. Now, he can try to put political pressure on them, and that's what people are doing. They're trying to build political pressure so the people who are in power will pay some attention to them. But as an American, I must say I haven't been very encouraged by the way in which the people who run the government of the United States have been listening to those contrary voices. And so long as the power to run the world lies in the hands of people who are quite happy to see it get warmer or fuel be used more, then those people who oppose it are crying in the wilderness. That's the real problem.
So your advice to the scientist who wants to emulate some of the public intellectuals in your own field, biology, would be to stick to your last, if you like, and be a critic. In other words, you can have a bullshit filter to take down the kind of misstatements that Stephen Jay Gould was expert at demolishing, and ultimately, nonetheless, stay in your field.
Yes, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't also become politically active. The question is to find the ways of becoming most effectively politically active. And that's a very hard problem.
The hard problem of effective politics, especially when science is at the heart of the matter. Richard Lewontin is Professor of Genetics at Harvard, and Bob May, whom we mentioned just now, is Lord May, the Australian who was once chief scientist in Britain. And we were prompted to talk about fame in science by a new book on Stephen Jay Gould called The Richness of Life, discussed in the New York Review of Books by Professor Lewontin. Let's have a final comment from its subject.
Obviously, we have enormous power to mess things up terribly. I don't think we have anywhere near enough power to inflict any permanent harm on the planet. I think people who worry about planetary health on geological scales are totally misguided. That's not the point at all. But that's the wrong scale. The right scale is the scale of our own lives and that of our children, our lineages, our bloodlines, our genealogies, the other species that we share the planet with. You see, with respect to a phenomenon like mass extinction, somebody might say, why worry about it? Because in geological perspective, mass extinctions aren't so bad. They wipe out some things, and then 10 million years down the road, you get new and interesting objects. But I tell you, mass extinctions are really awful for folks caught in the midst of them. And see, that's the right time scale. But I don't see how I could conceivably predict what's going to happen. Like all biologists, I simply acknowledge the gravity of the current situation. There are scenarios under which things work out well. And to that extent, I'm a cautious optimist.
Stephen Jay Gould, at least he was then in 1991. I wonder what he'd say today. Stephen Jay Gould in Australia. The book, once again, is The Richness of Life, edited by Stephen Rose. Next week at this time, I shall be in conversation with musician, physicist and author Professor Neville Fletcher of Canberra. And coming up on Catalyst in a couple of minutes' time on ABC television, gene therapy, the monster robot from New Zealand, and the star from the Health Report on ABC Radio National, Professor Alex Barrett, twice winner of the Eureka Prize. That's ABC television at 8. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. all the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.